Boy, dads are more fun. We're doing a bonus episode. I am on the road in Omaha, Nebraska, and sitting here in the hotel room. I hope I don't embarrass you, sir, but I'm going to be honest with some of our listeners may have heard me already talk about this gentleman. Those of you that come to us from the @Sammy blog, definitely know is that it's a cool weekend for me. Very few times I think you are lucky enough to work with one of your comedy heroes. But I am fortunate enough to be at the Omaha Funny Bone with Mr. Tom Wilson. And I am doubly fortunate enough that he agreed to do a bonus episode of the podcast because he is also a father. So, Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me, Justin. I am in the uncomfortable position.
Uh-huh.
I actually came to the hotel room to tell you I'm not doing the show.
Oh, that's
so
unfortunate.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation.
No, I just appreciate your time.
Take care.
You couldn't just, two more minutes maybe, or five?
Two?
Can you give me six, seven?
I'll give you two. We'll see
two?
How it goes.
Okay, we'll see how it goes. Uh-huh. And then if at any time you just want to get up and walk away, you just go for it.
That's pretty much my approach to life now. I'm taking it in 2-minute increments. And we'll see if I continue. We'll see if I quit. I don't know. I swear to you, I don't know what's going to happen in 2 minutes.
No.
We will see.
Okay. All right. I appreciate the fairness on that.
I have an odd vibrating timer in my pants. In my pocket. Not in my pocket.
Okay.
And it just goes off at 2-minute intervals. And I see if I walk away, if I start singing, I don't know what's going to happen.
Let's just for a quick thing, because I want to talk more about your parenting and stuff, but you're a stand-up comic, actor, you know.
Yeah.
How did you get into stand-up comedy?
I was studying acting.
Mm-hmm.
I was an arts kid in high school. I started as president of the debating team, you know. I was in the band, so music, theater.
How early on did you know that was what you wanted to do? A very young age, or...?
Not like being a little kid. Yeah. I was like so many kids going through high school just trying to figure out if I had any skill set whatsoever.
Yeah.
'Cause it didn't seem really strong that I was, you know, good at anything. I was a very sick kid when I was young. Had asthma and lung infection. I was absent from school for like 2 years out of the 4 years of high school. So, things weren't looking particularly strong. But I enjoyed music. I enjoyed the arts. You know, my parents would take us to concerts, to museums, to art museums, you know. So I loved that stuff. I gravitated toward it, and I did it through high school. Didn't seem like I had any skills at it until way late, 11th, 12th grade.
Uh-huh.
In 12th grade, I was the theater teacher approached me to audition for a play, which I didn't think about being an actor.
You were still in like the speech team at that point?
I was like sort of speech team,
yeah.
You know, music guy, tuba player in the band.
Nice.
Paint your own picture.
Chick
okay,
magnet.
Yeah. A tuba player with asthma, okay? Spent 4 years of high school just trying to make a sound out of the things. I can't catch the parade, Mom. They're walking too fast. So
why not go flute? Why not go or some drum situation? Or
it was all, you know, the flute players were girls.
Okay,
you know, not being sexist about it,
no.
But in the olden days,
yeah.
You know, they were all girls flute players, and drummers are stupid.
Yeah.
So I had to do some actual instrument, not just beating skins with sticks.
Yeah, right.
You're
not a cave person,
of course. No, I'm not.
You're
cave
for the artistic
man.
Integrity,
yeah, of course.
Yeah, I get it.
So I play the tuba. But then the teacher who oversaw the speech and debate and forensics team was the theater teacher. And he said, I think you should audition for a play. And at that time, being such a hip jazzy musician, I thought the actors were really weird kids.
Mm-hmm.
But I auditioned for the play, and then I just got cast as like the lead in every play.
Oh, wow. Do you remember the first couple plays that you
did? Yeah, The Crucible, John Proctor and The
Me
Crucible.
Me too. Nice.
Yeah, the Creature in Frankenstein.
Nice.
Will Parker in Oklahoma.
I was Judd Fry. That's how I met my wife.
Really?
Yeah, she was Dream Laurie.
Wow, Dream Laurie. That's
yes.
Good. That's good. The Laurie who can dance.
Exactly.
Yeah. Man, now we're getting obscure musical theater comedy.
Some of our listeners are like, well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. Yeah, one lady in Ottumwa, Iowa. I've always waited for a Dream Laurie joke. But yeah, so that was me. So I auditioned, and I I cut, you know, the,
and I forgot, we forgot to admit you grew up in Philadelphia.
I grew up in Philadelphia. Yeah,
Philadelphia.
Yeah, Philadelphia in the city for most of my life, and then just beginning of high school around then, whatever, moved out to the suburbs, out to Radnor, Villanova, near Villanova University out there. So I so the same teacher was the theater teacher, and then he just started putting me in plays, and so my senior year, I tell you, I just about cut everything. And just did plays.
Wow.
And just stayed in the arts program at my school. Because I really, you know, I didn't have a great time in high school. I wasn't a popular guy particularly. I was just kind of the unusual arts kid who was sick a lot, just mm-hmm. trying to fit in and always not succeeding mm-hmm. at that. So I just skipped a lot of stuff and just barely got by. And this teacher who had this theater room, and my high school had this kind of fine arts center, and then one of those long hallways, and then you get to the cafeteria, and then another long hallway, and then all the real classroom stuff. Well, I just stayed in the fine arts part of the school, and they never saw me in any other parts of the school.
I like that it's like the furthest from the education aspect.
Exactly. We know all the weird kids are going to be down here, so just give them a hallway.
Put the food in the middle. Right. Everybody will be fine.
Let them make their art pieces and their theater and do some music and that kind of stuff.
Hilarious.
So that's just what I did. But that was the start of it. That was the start of it. And then at the end of high school, I was I was going to college and going to begin trying to live a normal life, you know, trying to grasp a normalcy, but pretty quickly I figured out I couldn't do that.
Yeah, not going to happen.
Yeah, and the same teacher, by the way, I did a play with him over the summer after my senior year, and he was a great mentor to me and a serious guy. I mean, a very good teacher, but wasn't like so many good mentors, wasn't easy with the compliments.
Yeah.
You know, he was very hard taskmaster, even in the arts. So at the end of doing this play, after my senior year, he actually said, you know, you're the only student I've ever said this to, but I think you should become a professional actor. I said,
wow.
What do you mean? Well,
yeah,
I think I think you've got the talent for it. I think you could definitely do it. And right then I was kind of going off onto that kind of, I don't know, pre-law, political science, I don't know, businessy,
law is the closest to a regular job you can have and still perform.
Like. Buy a tie and a jar of Old Spice and just get on the train. And I don't know where I'm going or what I'm doing, but that's what guys do, right?
Yeah.
I'll read the paper and I'll just go, yeah, Ted, good point of that meeting today. I have no idea what they say, what they're talking about, you know.
Oh, that's great.
So pretty soon, pretty soon in college, I was just like, dude, I can't, you know, I'm just not cut out for this, man. I will be, you know, just howling at the moon if I have a regular job with normal people. I cannot act normal.
And so at what point then do you go to New York? Like, cause...
Right after that. After my I'd done a year at college, and then I just said, Mom, Dad, I'm moving to New York. Well, actually, in college, I was a freshman, and I just on a lark, there was a senior level improvisational acting class for seniors who were theater majors only. I was a freshman, new to the school, non-theater major, and I just went to audition for the class. I got into the class.
Did they not look back at all at what you were? Or like
you could,
you were...
With a special audition, you could audition to get into this
high-level class. Okay.
Yeah, but it was the hoi polloi of all the actors of the college. So I auditioned for this class. I got into the class. And at the end of the semester, the professor of the class said to me, you know, I've never said this to a student before, but these are all acting majors, and I think you should become a professional actor. So those two things with the college thing, I just went, yeah, I'm just going to go for this. I can come back. Hey, if I blow it, which, you know, you're a kid, you figure I probably will. Mm-hmm. It probably won't work out. You know,
but why not take a stab?
Right. You take a stab. I'll come back, whatever.
Yeah.
But for right now, I'm just going to go for it. So, Mom, Dad, I'm moving to New York City. I'm going to acting school. I'm going to be an actor and just, try to make my way that way.
So how is it at that point too that, because when we were talking before, you mentioned that then you kind of transitioned into doing stand-up while you were at the Academy for Dramatic Arts.
Yeah, I was going to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts and studying and, you know, all kinds of useless, you know, acting
walking around like an animal.
Yeah, the acting teachers do, because they have no idea what to tell you to do. Because they just are clueless. They've never had an acting job before in their lives. They're just like, dude, I don't know what to tell you what to do. So why don't we all act like monkeys?
Yeah.
And you're like, exactly how is this going to help anything for me spending a lot of money to learn what? What kind of a tree would you say you are? Really? I mean, literally.
Yeah,
literally. And acting. The girls are like, have their arms spread. And the class is supposed to like shout out what kind of tree they think it is.
Oh.
And people, you know, what? Maple. Oak. Yes, I was an oak.
Woo!
You go.
I conveyed my feelings.
The spirit of it, you know. And I'm just in the back going, you've got to be kidding. So like so many kids in the arts who are going to school and everything, in my opinion, the actual good ones just start to work so much that they can't go to class anymore. So that's kind of what happened. I started working in plays and working at night. A few of my friends who lived in New York City, they were doing stand-up. And they just, you know, they were doing these shows, improvisation. It was it wasn't new to the, you know, to the stage. Everyone had heard of it before. But it was a very good, this groundswell of excitement in nightclubs.
Was it that time when there was a transition from it just being a nightclub that had somebody up there talking and telling jokes to actually being a devoted comedy club? Like, were you around in New York when that happened?
I was around in New York when there were only a couple of, there was Catch a Rising Star, of course.
Uh-huh.
There was the Comic Strip, and there was the Improv. Those were basically the three clubs. All the other clubs, if you want, were kind of a variety club. And even at Catch a Rising Star, which became a stand-up club, it was really a variety club.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all kinds of music acts. I mean, Bette Midler sang at Catch a Rising Star. Pat Benatar. They would have, you know, musicians or a torch singer or somebody come up and sing a ballad or some guy come up like almost a vaudevillian kind of thing and eat a lot, you know, eat eggshells or, you know, some weird thing, and then a comedian. And then as the comedy boom started, I guess, in the, you know, early 80s into the mid 80s, it just became, hey, man, stand-up comics are just bringing people in, so it's just comedy shows. But, yeah, before that, it was a lot of clubs where, you know, whatever, Disco Tuesday night, stand-up Wednesday night, Foxy Boxing Thursday night.
Yeah.
You know, so you were
almost like one-nighter bars are today.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, it really was like that. That was most of stand-up was going around to one-nighters at bars,
mm-hmm.
you know, in Philadelphia, New York City.
So you're doing stand-up, and did you finish at the American Academy?
No, I didn't.
Left early because you were working?
Yeah, I've studied a lot of schools, and I've managed to successfully avoid graduating from any of them.
Congratulations.
Thank you, yeah.
Wow.
It's something I had to work hard at. But I don't know. I'm just kind of a, you know, it's, what is its utility to me?
Yeah.
You know, I was always kind of like, I think I've exhausted what I can get out of this.
Yeah.
Other than a sheepskin. And I think in the arts, that just doesn't mean anything.
No, it doesn't. Yeah.
You know, it doesn't mean anything. I mean, it's good to study. It's good to work on your skill set.
Yeah.
It's good to do all of those exercises and those things that make you stronger. But when you get out there as a painter, a musician, an actor, or anything, nobody cares that I graduated from this, or this guy, this girl, they said, see, look at this. They say I'm good. Doesn't matter, man.
No.
It's either on the stage or it's not on the stage.
Yeah.
It's either happening, it's not. And I think everyone just senses that immediately.
What point then after that do you go to L.A.?
It took a couple of years. Then I was studying acting at this workshop and that thing and this theater and doing this weird play, and but you know, I just wasn't casting stuff because I was you're a young guy.
Yeah,
there aren't many parts in plays for a 19, 20 year old guy or whatever. So I started looking. I started looking to the West Coast. Honestly, a couple casting directors. I had auditions in New York for plays. And here I am, you know, 6'3", blonde kid. I'm from Philadelphia, but I look like I'm from Nebraska.
Yeah.
You know, just big, all-American kind of looking guy.
Yeah.
And the casting people were like, listen, I think you're terrific. You know, I think it's just great. But here's the, I mean, honestly, nobody's casting people like you right now. You know, there are no shows. We're not doing like Oklahoma or Shenandoah or some big American thing. You know, at that point, Al Pacino was doing Richard III on Broadway. You had to be like 5'5" and really, really dark, you know, dark hair and a really New York kind of vibe. And I certainly didn't have that. So these people are going, look, go to L.A., you know. Do a show, do a movie, do something like that where they're actually casting people like you, you know, because it's not, you're great, but it's just not happening here.
Yeah.
So I took that to heart, and I was, one of the first comics of that generation, I guess, to go, I'm moving to LA, guys. See ya.
Did they all think you were nuts? They were like,
everyone really, paid close attention to what happened to me because I think everyone had it in their minds.
Yeah.
Because New York has a lot of gigs. You know, there are a lot of clubs and a lot of Tuesday night and you drive to New Jersey and you get $40, but they have good cheeseburgers there and all, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, even to me, like looking at the East Coast, because it's so condensed, like there seems to be a lot more opportunity of work where you could just drive. Whereas on the West Coast, almost every show you gotta fly or drive at least 4 or 5 hours.
Exactly. So there's not as much work on the West Coast, and I think that's still true today.
Yeah.
It's still true. And they're less.
And it's weird because it's not necessarily about population. It's more just about how expansive the metropolises are, I guess.
LA is just horizontal.
Yeah.
It's a horizontal city, you know? And when you get back east, it's all vertical. I mean, people just, there's no more room over there. Let's just stack them up, you know? So, you know, there's a lot of population. I mean, you know, the Comedy Magic Club there out in LA, it's in Hermosa Beach. And Mike Lacy, the owner, it's on the beach. So Mike Lacy's always joking, like half of his possible sales demographic is fish.
That's funny.
You know, I mean, he has to attract people only from the east because there are three surfers and they're just waiting for waves. Exactly. They don't want a comedy show.
Yeah.
So I moved west in order to act, really.
Yeah.
And I got accepted as a regular at the Comedy Store on the Sunset Strip, which was kind of lucky, but that was unheard of, to come into L.A., audition at the Comedy Store the first time, boom, you're a regular.
You're in,
call in for spots, and just start getting spots.
And now I don't think that is the place to be, but then that was the place to be.
Yeah. That was the place, probably in the country, to be. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Richard Pryor was working out every night doing his warming up his show. He was doing those stand-up films at the time, Live on the Sunset Strip and all those movies that he was doing. So he was at the Comedy Store every night.
Yeah.
You know, Robin Williams was at the Comedy Store every night. I mean, anyone that you could, you know, Jay Leno was driving his motorcycle into the parking lot every single night.
And I would imagine, like, cuz today if you had even that lineup, were they as big of a name and a draw? I mean, Richard Pryor, obviously, he's doing huge comedy films, but the people that are these major, you know, stars now, were they still that same draw then?
Were huge. The place was packed.
Yeah, all the time.
The place was packed. I packed to the gills on Tuesday night, you know, every night.
Yeah.
Because people just, they expected to see stars come in like them and do a show, but you just, at this point, it's weird to look back on it, but I cannot overstate how hip stand-up was.
Yeah.
You know, how it was the place to be. I mean, when I came in, I'm 21, 22 years old, and Mick Jagger's in the room, and Willie Nelson's in the room, and the bands are in the room, and that's whatever, you know, every kind of rock and roll group or whatever, you're right over there, man. It's Black Sabbath. They're in a booth. They're in the booth at the back. They're watching the show. Whomever, you know.
Yeah.
Everyone was coming to the show. I remember Mick Jagger. They got him on stage, you know. Just kind of a job. Mick, come over here. And Mick Jagger coming on stage in this tiny, the original room at the Comedy Store. I just want to say I really respect what these guys do. They put their souls on the line. They're sharing their soul with you. Give it up for them. They're unbelievable, you know, and just go back and sit down. Thanks, Mick. But that kind of thing is what was going on. This is pre, you know, that comedy boom of the mid-80s. This is early 80s when there was something bubbling under the surface of, man, this is really happening.
Oh, I'm sorry. We can hear that. I apologize.
Oh, sorry,
no, it's
sorry.
All right. No, it's okay. So at what point then did you, is it around this time in the early 80s that you met your now wife or?
Yeah. Yeah. I met my now wife in like, what, 1983 about? Yeah.
And how did you guys meet? Can I ask?
We met at a comedy store in Westwood. There were two comedy stores in LA. There's one. There was one in San Diego. But there was a Westwood one that was an old folk club. The name just escaped me, but it was an old folk club where like John Denver played when he was a young guy, and all those the Love and Spoonful played or whatever. So she changed Mitzi Shore, who owned the comedy store, changed it into a comedy club, and I was working there, and you know, like so many, I mean, I was standing next to the kitchen, stealing nachos off people's plates before they went into the showroom. And Caroline was in line for the ladies' room, and we were just standing next to each other.
And then, like, what had it? You just see that's a lovely lady, so why not ask her out? Or is that, she giving you the eye at all?
I think she was giving me a little bit of eye.
Nice.
You know, but I was very inept at any of that sort of thing. I couldn't read those signals. I don't know what. I was a weird kid. You know, I was just doing shows. I was just like a ball of energy, just getting on stage and doing shows and stealing nachos off people's plates and just
so like
doing
a 22-year-old, 10-year-old, in the sense that you're not even aware of that aspect. Like you're like this
I was
is
aware
what I
of like
to.
Girls and yeah, stuff. Yeah. You know, wow, she's pretty or whatever. But I wasn't a player.
Yeah.
You know, I was just a guy doing shows and just thinking I'm gonna put all my energy into this and see where this leads, you know. So we had a very nice conversation, and I, you know, asked her name and everything, and we had very nice, and I just was like, okay, well, you know, nice talking to you, bye.
You didn't get the number?
No, I'm gonna go do a show now, you know. So I didn't know, you know. So I did my show and I just left. The next night I went out I was roommates with Yakov Smirnoff, the Russian comedian, and Andrew Dice Clay. We rented a house above the comedy store, and Yakov and I went out to dinner, and then we just went over to the comedy store. Neither of us had spots or anything. We just went there to hang out, have a drink, whatever.
Yeah,
just
walking,
make trouble, just
20 feet away.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So we just walked down the hill, and we're just hanging around, and a guy comes up who was in the party that my now wife was in the previous night, the night before. He just came out to the Hollywood comedy store, not the Westwood comedy store. So he walks up to me and says, hey, do you remember meeting a girl last night or whatever? I don't, what do you mean?
You know? Do you think like this is her boyfriend maybe?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I blonde, you know, tall. I talked to somebody who was, well, you know, she, you know, she sort of liked you and something, you know. So he gave me her phone number.
That's awesome.
Her friend gave me her phone number. So
but
you
pure
should,
happenstance.
You know,
like
yeah,
you
pure
just...
happenstance. So you should call her. You
That's
should call
cool.
her. I mean, you know. So, and still, I'm like, really?
All right.
Okay. Yeah. You know? So, So I called her. I called her, I think, the next day or something. And we just, you know, nice conversation. And it was... You know, it was just, by our second date on, we just saw each other every day.
Wow.
It was just like we got along. I don't know. We went on a date. It went great, you know. And then like our second date, we just kind of go out to dinner and then we're just every day.
Yeah.
Got to see. And we just kind of locked in. We just got along and everything was good.
Off the air or whatever, for lack of a better term, but we've kind of joked about how like if they made a reality TV show about your life, that it would just be you and your family having a pizza, sitting around the table, you know, just hanging out, doing regular family stuff. So to me, like, you almost seem like the kind of guy where it's fun that there's no big deal about everything. It's just hanging out and laughing occasionally and doing stuff.
There was really no big deal.
And that's appealing. Like, because I know that's kind of what I liked about my wife was that the low maintenance factor within her. You know what I mean? That she's just kind of a chill girl. And
yeah. And there is, I mean, within that, of course, is excitement
yes.
and passion
oh, yes,
and
yeah.
love and
yes.
all of those things. But I think it's great if it begins with just a very nice person who you're getting along with.
Yeah.
And who you end up, you know, you go out to dinner and you end up talking for a couple of hours and just, you know, agreeing on things and just, it's just very nice.
Yeah.
And you go, wow, that was great.
That was easy.
You know,
yeah,
and then
yeah.
after the second date, you're just like, well, I'm calling her today. I know it's the day after, but I just feel like it, you know?
That's cool.
And then instead of doing that kind of play coy and we'll go have a pizza in 2 weeks, and like the next day you just go, well, are you just sitting there? Well, let's go right now and just do something.
Was she any kind of performer or anything? Or
no, she... no. She was, at that point, she was just graduating from UCLA with a degree in math.
Nice.
So she was very smart.
The brains of the operation.
She certainly is the brains of the operation, believe me. So she, she graduated with a degree in math, and she was working at a bank at that time, and I was just a comedian. So for her, for me and my family, it was unusual enough for me to become kind of an actor and comedian in Hollywood. But for her also, just to go to a comedy club and end up just, you know, meeting some guy who ends up doing a show. And then you're like dating, like, you know, well, what does he do? Oh, he's a comedian. He works at the Comedy Store down on the Sunset Strip. What? You can date those people? They're not crazy people on drugs? Because I've seen that on TV.
Seen that. Yeah, I know.
They're
I
all
know.
Lenny Bruce died. He's dead. Whatever. You know?
He gave up hookers for you?
Yeah. Wow. How can, you know... Are there drugs in his bedroom, like up to your knees? Are you getting stuck with syringes?
You're not doing that, are you?
Like- no, he just has, like most guys, a couple of empty pizza boxes and some T-shirts, you know?
His place smells funny sometimes.
Yeah, smells funny, and, you know, he's just got some T-shirts and stuff, and he just kind of hangs out and does shows, you know?
That's funny. At what point did it ever come up beforehand? Like, were you like, I'm going to ask this chick to marry me, or how does that happen then?
That was a while, I think, a year and a half or something like that. Mm-hmm. It starts dawning on you that, I don't know, I guess maybe guys don't think, like, wouldn't that be wonderful? We don't think with like little doves and sparklies like falling from the sky.
Yeah.
We start thinking, well, I mean, if I don't marry this girl, I must be a moron.
Yeah.
You know?
It's always like illogical. Like, this is the next step.
Of course it is. Because, I mean... What am I, stupid? Yeah. I mean, what am I going to do? I'm just going to break up with her? Well, the time's up. I have to move on. I mean, I like you. I love you. I think you're great. But a year and a half, I think we're done.
Yeah. We had a good run, though.
Yeah, good run. Congratulations.
Well done.
I've made a plaque. And here
Here's
you go.
A coffee mug. It's got a picture.
Yeah. So you just go, man, I'd be crazy. You know, so I... And again, not that I was any kind of playboy or anything or what. I just didn't see myself as a guy who would get married when I was, 26. But I just did because I wanted to, you know.
Do you remember how you did it? Was it anything like...
I bought an engagement ring probably, I think, in like early October. The idea was, I'm just going to buy it. I'm going to keep it in my pocket. I'm going to wait, maybe Christmas present, maybe Thanksgiving.
When did you buy it? Late October, sorry. Yeah.
No, early October.
Oh, early October,
or like
okay.
even maybe late September, something like that. You know, so
you got a ways that you got to sit on
it. Yeah, I got a ways, I'm sitting on it, but I just go out and I'm thinking, well, you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas, it's coming, but whatever. So you buy this ring, and it's in your pocket, and it just has its own, like, gravitational, but it's just... It just has a heartbeat. You know, like, I got it.
Every time you're looking at her, that's all you're
exactly.
Thinking.
Exactly. I don't...
I did something incredibly stupid. I don't think I've told this story on the show, but I had gotten my ring on a layaway, and I had the paperwork sitting in a bag behind my wife, and my wife had brought up the idea of marriage in a year or two, in a couple years. Like, well, we'll get married in a couple years. And I thought it would be funny, because I am a moron, to say... Oh, whoa, let's not get too nuts here with this marriage thing. And my wife looks at me and was like, What do you mean? I go, well, you know, I mean, 2 years, that's kind of quick. I mean, maybe 3, 5, something like that, you know. And I'm thinking, I'm hilarious.
Yeah,
behind her is the ring. It's so funny. Oh, this is, I'm just so amused with myself while I'm driving down the freeway. And then I look back at my wife and she's just bawling her eyes out. I go, oh, no. What's going on? Like, what's going on? She's like, well, I just thought that you felt some way about me, and now I find that I'm feeling something different about you, and this just, we're not on the same page. And I'm like, oh, no. Now, like, I got to get out of this. Otherwise, my proposal is going to be like, look, I'm like a quarter of the way through the payment plan before I get back. Like, I have to show her paperwork. Like, I did it already. Like, she's crying. I go, hey. This is what I came up with. I said, listen, you're happy, right? I mean, barring what I just, you know...
we have a good life together. We were already living together at that point, you know. And she's like, yeah, I go, I'm happy too. It's not broke. Let's not worry about fixing it. Let's just get through it. And she was like, okay. And little did I know that she had decided that day that if I did not ask her to marry her by the end of the year, she was just going to bail on me. Mm-hmm. And I luckily I was able to pay off the ring before the summer, and then it all worked out. But it's just so, you know, so stupid, you know.
Yeah. But that's guys.
Yeah,
that's just guys. We'll do whatever it is. We'll do it wrong.
Yeah,
but
sure.
You know, and we'll just go, sorry here. Yeah. I don't know what even to say there. Look.
So your ring is burning a hole in your pocket.
Yeah. So I just literally, I mean, like in a day, in a day. I'm just like, we got it. I don't even know how to do it. I don't know how to do it. I don't know what I'm going to say. Let's take a ride.
Just gets weird.
We're just driving around the town. I'm just driving. Yeah. I'm just driving.
Like, sweating, I don't,
yeah, exactly. Just and she's, of course, like, what is going on? What is losing his mind?
She probably think that he's trying to break up with her, maybe.
Yeah,
too,
like. Exactly. We finally, I go to Santa Monica Pier. So I'm thinking, oh, something historic, something memorable, the ocean. We'll go to the ocean. We'll be able to remember this. The ocean.
Something historic.
Yeah.
I love it.
So, you know, go drive out to the Santa Monica Pier. We're walking around Santa Monica Pier at that time. It's nighttime. Yeah. They're just homeless people. People with knives sticking out of their necks and stuff.
Ocean and the smell of urine is in the air.
It's just bad carnival people looking at what's the big white guy and the chick doing out here this hour of night.
Why is he sweating so?
Yeah. So we just, you know, take her out to the pier and the ocean, all that stuff. And I'm standing there for 10 minutes. So what other sports do you like? You know, I'm just making stuff up. I don't know how to get there.
It's,
you know,
such an amazing irrational fear, because on some level you have to know that she's on board too, right? Is it a fear of rejection, or is it just the nervous of the decision? Like, you think?
I think it's both. Yeah. I think it's both. I think there's a lot of fear of rejection, but I think, you know, it's so, you know, we just try to do the right thing or say the right thing, and in the extra trying, it actually just explodes.
It just makes it so
into
much.
Ugliness. It's just stupid ugliness that fortunately these fine women are patient with us, you know. I just go, I realize you're a moron. Yeah. Okay. Because you're just trying. You're just like a dumb guy with crayons going, I like you.
Yes or no.
Yeah, right. Just let's keep it here. I bought this with money I made. So I take it out. Hey, would you marry me? She says yes, and you know, and that was it. And then the rest is history.
Did you have any kind of like a big like flashy ceremony or anything along those lines?
We didn't have a flat. No, I didn't have much money at that time. I mean, in fact, well, I didn't.
Was her family from Southern California,
yeah,
too?
Yeah, her family's from Southern California. They weren't crazy about me. They weren't crazy about the whole thing. Yeah, because I was like showbiz and all that stuff. So.
Unstable, quote unquote.
Yeah, that stuff. So we had a lot of those
income,
kinds
I mean,
of
not mentally. I'm sorry.
No, both.
Oh, both. Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
And they were only right in one case.
Oh.
No, actually, both. Yeah, so we just paid for, you know, I mean, I guess a medium wedding, mm-hmm. as much as, you know, you just do as much as you can afford. You try to get the affordable chicken dish.
Yeah.
You know, you make your thing. I mean, I think at this point, you know, as I tell people when they're, you know, getting married or whatever, like one thing at your wedding is probably going to be way better than you thought.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing is going to be terrible. You know? And
we've definitely talked about that on the show, where it's like there's so much pressure put on this day that is... Everything that you end up stressing about is so unbelievably unnecessary.
Yeah.
Like, it's...
and one thing, and they're going to blow something's going to be, you know, either the food or whatever, the flowers. Oh, I mean, that was the flowers.
That's not the way I wanted.
That DJ, whatever. So our DJ was a joke, but our flowers were great.
Yeah,
you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So that's the best you can do. Uh-huh. You know, but it's not about the flowers or the DJ or the you know the food. So we got married.
How long after you guys were married did you have your first kid, can I ask?
2 years.
Mm-hmm.
2 years.
Was it a thing that just kind of happened? Or because I think now, and I don't know if it was the same for you, but now there's kind of like a planning type situation where you almost, I mean, there are obviously surprises that exist, but I'm saying that it's almost like, okay, now we're going to start having children, where, you know, was that kind of the thing with you guys too? Or
I don't think so. I think it was just kind of, okay, here we are. Let's.
How did you find out you're going to be a dad? Was it?
I was in Las Vegas.
Oh,
I was not with her when I found out we were going to have our first baby. I was in a, I was in the showroom of the Dunes Hotel, which is now, it was destroyed years ago to make the Bellagio now, at the old site. I was backstage at the Dunes Hotel with Damon Wayans, I think Tamayo Otsuki, a Japanese comedian, Harry Basil. I think Blake Clark was there. Just a bunch of comedians in this in the, at the main showroom at Dunes Hotel. So I heard that we might be pregnant in the afternoon, and then
now this is like pre cell phones too, like right?
This is for, yeah,
yeah. Like, actually, so yeah. What is it?
No,
like
this was whispered down the lane. She had to just shout really loudly to the east.
A carrier
just,
pigeon
exactly,
came
exactly. A chuck wagon came up. Is there a Tom Wilson here?
Now it sounds like I'm insulting you.
No,
saying,
it's fine.
I'm trying to provide a context, you know, because I caught myself imagining you in the showroom with a cell phone to your head, and I'm like, no, wait a minute, that doesn't fit.
No yeah. cell phones existed. No, yeah. this was later that night. I found, you know, in the afternoon, I think we might be pregnant. Wow, really? And then she had to call the Dunes Hotel and get, you know, through the operator, transferred. Like, can I get backstage? Can I, you know, to the backstage phone before the show. So before the show, she says, yep, you know, it's happening. We're pregnant. And the comedians there, we had a great celebration, and they bought, you know, Dom Perignon champagne and the cool. casino bosses. I spent, you know, the celebration with a bunch of mafia figures. She's going, hey, I really hope that this child is a strong and masculine child. You know, well, thank you very much, Vito. Thank you so much. That's very kind of you. And if that child should need anybody's knees broken at any time, please feel free to call me or any of my union representatives here in Las Vegas. So it was good. It was a Las Vegas
pregnancy.
So this
pregnancy. Is pre-Vegas family-friendly Vegas.
Yeah, this is pre-family-friendly Vegas. Yeah. Yeah.
So then this is your daughter, right? You had a daughter
I
first?
I had a daughter first.
Yeah. Now when you... Did you find out you were going to have a girl beforehand, or was it like a delivery room thing, or how did that
no,
work?
No. I think we found out. That was the very beginning. Yeah, that was, I mean, of course they had ultrasound and all that stuff, but you didn't get all the 3D, DVD stuff. They just kind of said, we think it's a girl.
We don't see anything, so.
Right, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we knew that was a girl.
Were you scared at all to have a girl, or?
I don't think I was. No, I think my brothers were, you know, my brothers are younger than me, so they were all, well, I hope it's a boy. I got to play wiffle ball with somebody, you know, that thing.
Yeah.
And so I was just jazzed to, you know, to have a healthy baby, and I was very happy it was a girl. And of course, my brothers changed it to the first day. You know, the guys are always like that with girls, you know. Yeah. Well, I don't know what to do with one. And then the girl comes out, and then they love that girl
right?
to death. They'll
There's something to be
anything.
Said about that moment that you see the kid there, like the baby there, and like it is a weird like chemical connection that you feel emotionally happen, like just boom. Like.
Well, my mom said that before you have a baby. My mom told us both, you know, and it people without kids just don't understand it really as viscerally as mm-hmm. parents do, which is my mom saying, listen, before you have a child, you really can't understand. Those stories of people lifting a car off their child or pushing over a train. And then you have a child and then you go, of course. Yeah. Of course you lift a car. Of course you push over a train.
It's a whatever. Very motivating thing.
Right. You do whatever you need to do.
Yeah.
You do whatever you need to do. Your life changes entirely. And your priorities change entirely, and it's great.
So how much after your daughter is born do you have your second child?
Couple years after that, 2 years after that,
and was that another thing? Like, hey,
daughter.
This is great. Let's do it again. Or?
Sure, my wife, Caroline was. I mean, we were both thought we'd have some number of children, not huge, but you know, but a couple, three, who knows? But she just took to it, man. She just found like what she wanted to do mm-hmm. with life, and this is a woman who's quite accomplished. I mean, you know, math major, working in the defense industry, working. for, like, I don't know, the government and
stuff. I don't know what she does.
I'm serious. No, I don't know what she did. I don't know what she did. She worked in, like, some top secret clearance thing that I'm not allowed to know the extent of her security.
Oh, wow.
No kidding.
I thought it was more just like you're an artsy guy who numbers aren't your thing. You're like, she tells me things and I just don't understand.
Well, that's true, too. Yeah. Both are true. I said, well, it's lucky. I don't even care what you do because I couldn't understand the first thing about it. But my first time I was on Letterman like years ago, and he's just kind of going off the path and asking me, "Well, you married? Oh yeah. Well, what'd your wife do?" I said, "Well, Dave, she has a job in the defense industry. I really don't know what she does." And he was just, you're kidding, right?
There's your segment.
Yeah. What? What do you mean? And like all we were my wife, the double knot spy, who's just, you know, whatever. I said, Dave, she has a security clearance. Literally, I don't know the extent of it. I'm not allowed to know what she does.
Yeah.
So that was true. But then, you know, then she had the kids and was like, I want to do this.
Just want to be a mom.
I want to be a mom. I want to take care of them. I want to help them grow up and be there and make them, you know, make them a peanut butter and jelly after school. And she just was, you know, the most unbelievable mom there is.
So now you got two girls,
yeah, two
and
girls.
Then you have four kids total.
I do.
So how much after the second one then does the third one come
two
along?
Two more years. Boom. We get in a schedule.
Do you celebrate your anniversary every other year? What's going on with this situation?
Yeah, it's just we're very busy. And I was doing a lot of shows. Doing a lot of shows, out of town a lot.
My sister, I realized recently that both of her kids, their birthdays are around March.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I was like, but like 2-3 years apart. So I'm like, seems like somebody was getting a little birthday gift, something. I don't know what's going on.
So we had three girls in a row. Mm-hmm. And for a while there, you know, the people with numbers of kids. No, we had a 4-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a newborn.
Wow.
And it's good to be alive.
Yeah. He made it through.
Made it through that, man.
And barely then another 2 years is when you had your son?
No, my son was a break. My son, we just took a break.
Yeah.
I mean, not a planned break, but we just kind of...
Just happened
that
way.
Just didn't have one for a while.
Yeah.
And then he was born, what, 96?
Yeah.
So 4 years or 5 years after.
Okay, so now what I would like to do, because we get a little bit of flack from our listeners, because my co-host Bill Glass, he has a couple of boys. One's 4, one's 3. Oh, I'm sorry, 5 and 3. I have a 2.5-year-old, another one on the way. We talk a lot about being in the toddler stage and everything, and then they like to hold over our heads, because we joke that it's like a 4-year prison sentence in the beginning until they can kind of become close to a human being. That's where. So I'm looking to you to be the light at the end of the tunnel, but some of our listeners say, "Oh, this is nothing." You know, I don't look back at the potty training days with excitement. You know what I mean? But wait till they become teenagers and the like. So you're kind of in the throes of the end of that teenager era. What was?
Well, the thing is, once they hit 13, I don't pay any attention to them anymore.
Oh, that helps. I bet.
So
yeah.
I just let it go.
Yeah. Okay.
I did my part. There's some food. There's a bed.
That's.
You're not getting wet in the rain, are you? Are you getting wet in the rain? No, Daddy. Then shut your mouth and keep moving. By 13, you know, either whatever. You get to school on the bus or get a job, whatever it is.
But can you, like, what do you remember about those toddler years with the little ones?
Well, the toddler years is a lot of, you know, putting out fires. You know, it's a lot of kind of emergency situations, whether an emergency is just finding a cookie or an emergency is going to the doctor. You know, I mean, there are lots of kind of emergencies when kids are screaming.
Yeah, you know, it's either out. You're right. It's either an off or it's pegged.
Like exactly. There's exactly. There's no middle ground. No. And it is nice to get to a place where you're coming in at sixes, fours, not 1 to 10, 1, 10, you know, sleeping or screaming. But, you know, I enjoyed it very much. I enjoyed it very much. And my wife was excellent at the juggling of chainsaws that these ladies do, you know, of having so many little kids just driving you crazy. So I know from your act, you mentioned it, but, you know, years ago, I had a lot of material like that myself, talking about it, talking about just the frustration or the craziness of being the guy with four little kids going into the restaurant, you know, and just trying not to destroy everyone else's dinner.
Yeah.
Trying to keep them quiet.
I'm doing my best here.
Just giving them toys, whatever, sugar packets. Look, it's like money, $1, $2, $3, whatever, anything. Here, eat the sweet and low. It's not that bad for you, I don't think.
Yeah.
and you know, playing with, look, shiny object, you know, steak knives, look, yeah, play with this, what, anything to just stop, give now me crackers.
You get, that's funny, I just realized, now you get to enjoy a hot meal, whereas right now my wife and
exactly,
I, we get lukewarm
so
if we're lucky.
So finally, yeah, finally, it's more expensive because all the kids are now eating like adults. So when you go out, you suddenly go, $87? Yeah, my son is 14. He goes, could I have a fourth cheeseburger? Dude, stop eating. I'm still hungry. But the, you know, the great part about it is, it, well, it does even out, you know. I went up to a dad a couple months ago, and it was on a plane, and he's got three kids on the plane, and they're just having a horrible time. And this one's screaming, and the other one's trying to go to the bathroom, and the drink cart is in the aisle, and they start screaming. And you could just see the guy's eyes. Like,
and he's by himself?
No, his wife is there. She's taking care of the baby.
Yeah, okay.
And he's trying to wrangle the toddlers. Mm-hmm. And, man, he's like, phew, this is not what I bargained for, you know? Yeah. And I just lean over the aisleway to say, hey, you know, my friend, I have four kids. I've been exactly where you are. I know what it's like. Believe me. And, you know, it gets better than this. And I'll tell you, these are the stories you tell.
Yeah.
You don't tell the perfect story of going to Disneyland.
Yeah.
You tell the story was like the one had diarrhea and I was trying to run through this rainforest cafe, but the balloon animal guy was in the way, so we have this problem around the blooming onions, whatever, you know. Those are the stories you tell because that's, to me, what it, being a family is all about. It is crazy.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
It is kind of, I never thought of that. It is kind of celebrating the trauma of the progress.
It like, is. Yeah. It's the trauma. Yeah. You've decided to, you wanted to do it.
Listeners have a lot of stories of their kids defecating on their husband's bosses and the like. You know?
Absolutely.
Like,
yeah. That's what it's all about.
That's why we do this.
That's how it happens. None of us have perfect lives. That's what kids do, you know?
Do you have, because you've been through the whole spectrum, you know what I mean? Your oldest is now an adult and working.
Yeah.
And so do you have, like, is there a favorite part at all, or is it?
I don't think so. I really don't. I think every part has surprises in it. I mean, I enjoyed the process of my kids. I'm about my family, you know? Yeah. I've been married 25 years. I'm all about just my wife and kids. If you want to know me, that's me. So I have loved the process. Does every aspect of the process have challenges? Absolutely. Absolutely, man. I mean, like once the kids go into college or you're sending them to a high school and just, you know, all those financial things, school tuitions, whatever. And you realize, man, I got to just, you know, it's my job to just pull the plow, man. I got to, you know, pay for stuff.
Yeah.
Like not only just kind of pizzas, you know, babies a lot. You know, it costs money, yes, and pediatricians, yes, and all that stuff. But man, toddlers are kind of just some pocket cash, you know? A 20 here, a 40 here, 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds, man. You know,
more wheelbarrows.
More wheelbarrows of money, just, you know, and not to buy them the Beamer to impress their friend. I mean, just hanging on.
Get them the Nissan Altima.
Right, buying pizzas, getting them to class, getting them to their swim meet, picking them up from that, paying for the weekend trip to the whenever. You know, it's significant. So dad just becomes you better get your game face on and get through that part. But the great part about that is all of that work usually, you know, comes out in great people.
Yeah.
You've raised a kind and loving and wonderful person that, you know, at the end, it's not the end, of course, but you're just going, man, I can't believe that a screw up like me could make such a great kid.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Do you, like, because I'm looking at your situation from where I'm standing and it kind of, it looks like you're almost on the home stretch. Now, I know we've talked about it, and I've said what my dad said on the show, is that you're never really done parenting, even when they're gone.
Well, my mom says it now. My mom's 74. And she says about me, because like, I travel, you know, I have four kids, you know, two of them are out of the house and everything. But she says, you know, you think there will be a point where you stop. You think, he's coming for a landing.
Yeah.
He's okay.
I'm done now.
She says, you know, I'm 74. She's sitting there in Philadelphia going, well, he's going to Omaha, and maybe the people won't like him, and maybe his plane was something. You know, you just
she worries about
me. She worries about how my shows do. She worries about the plane. You know, all of those things. Just, you know what? Because she's a mom.
Mom, yeah.
She's my mom, and you know, so she said, "You never stop. You're always their mom or their dad. You know, so you always care about them." And you always, of course, want to just rescue them from everything. But that's being a mature parent. Raising a mature child is just letting them struggle and almost drown and get stronger. And then if you have to pull in, of course, you get in there. Okay,
you try to resist
help.
That urge.
That'll help. But you try to resist the urge so they get stronger.
Yeah. So do you have any form of like an empty nest like feeling now that you've got two out of the house or
not really quite yet? Our house has always been kind of Grand Central Station.
That's true. Yeah, they always come back every weekend still, huh?
And they're friends. I mean, I always have people just sleeping on a sofa or on a bunch of girls sleeping on my den floor. Like, hi, Mr. Wilson. Okay, I don't even remember who you are, dear. But just have some pizza and just have fun, guys. Whatever. So we're one of those houses where we just, you know, always welcomed everybody, and you know, and that's worked out great. But it's, you know, it's still quite a busy house. Lots of stuff going on.
I want to try to start to wrap it up here, but usually when we end the show, sometimes the show can get a little complainy, if you would, and it's a vent session for me and our co-host, so that, you know, and Dad's kind of vent with us by listening, kind of thing. So we like to wrap up with like a moment of the week that we had for each of our kids, for multiple of them. But I want to talk to a little bit about, as we get towards that, I was just giving you a heads up on that. But while we were at lunch, you got, I hope you don't mind me sharing this, the phone call you got from your son.
My son is just doing fantasy baseball for the first time.
Yeah.
So he's just calling me. He's calling Dad on the road to say, yeah, I got Chase Utley.
Yeah.
I got Joey Votto of the Reds. I think he's going to be a power hitter this year. So he's really, I mean.
And you're not a huge sports guy.
My son loves, but he eats, breathes, sleeps baseball. So I'm considering having like red stitching tattooed on my face so he'll look at me thinking I'm an incoming pitch. So it's one of those things with kids where I think it's those teenage years, you know, if you want to keep connected to them or stay talking to them, not that I'm a baseball encyclopedia, but dude, I'd better watch some games and start learning.
Well, that's what I was impressed with, is that you and I had talked and you said you had told me about your son's love for baseball and how you weren't really a sports guy. You know, it's not like you hated sports or anything like that, but it just wasn't a tremendous interest to you.
Right.
And then now you're throwing back these names at him, and you're like, oh, I think this guy will be good. And then your draft's not over. You can go for this guy. And
exactly.
I was like, man, this guy's done some homework just out of the love that he has for his kid.
Because I just want to talk to him. Because when I pick him up from school, I just don't want to be silent looking out the window.
Yeah.
You know, I can start a conversation by just saying, wow, Brad Lidge of the Phillies, I don't know how he's going to open the season. He's on the DL, huh? Shoulder problems?
Mm-hmm.
And that goes into him going, yeah, but I got CeCe Sabathia on my team, and he's a middle reliever. You know, so it starts a conversation, and then I'm like, so how are your friends doing? And then we're talking about his friends or what he did for lunch. So, you know, I enjoy it, and it just brings us closer.
Which we've talked about, too, on the show, and some of our parents have shared that have teenagers, is that it's very important during that aspect of their life, or their time of their life is a better way to say it, is to keep that open dialogue going, because then it keeps you invested, and it doesn't let them kind of get too far out of reach.
I think it's so, well, now I'm being, you know, junior family therapist or something, but I think, you know, I see so many people, and it's very frustrating, because teenagers can be difficult, you know, but I think people are throwing up their hands way too quick.
Yeah.
Just going, okay, go out with Gina. Duh, Joe, just get off my back. Rather than really being engaged with them and hanging on to the bull in the big rodeo, you know, people are just going, okay, forget it. Go out with her. No, I'm just staying in there, man. I'm hanging on for dear life, staying engaged with them. And as I tell my wife, I'm perfectly willing to wait until they're 27 before they thank me for the way I raised them.
Yeah.
But the fortunate thing is they've done it at 21, 22,
oh, that's cool.
23, in saying that, you know, when they grow up to those ages, they can see, they look back, and those tough times, they just saw both of their parents saying, I'm not letting go of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm hanging on to you. I'm hanging on to this relationship, and I'm just hanging in there with you, loving you and being there and learning about your things and helping you, but not letting you, you know, go off the path too far. because you're just not gonna.
Yeah,
you know. And I think you know that's that stuff that starts when they're two, when they just figure out, oh, you can't mess with this guy.
That's a good point, because I know that I have done that, because I've had a lot of situations in front of me, especially when you work the road as a comedian. You meet the occasional damaged person, you know, and sure. You kind of, and not as a way of, I don't know, of talking down about or bad about them, but just using it as a way to reflect and be appreciative of your situation. So I will send a text message to my mom or an email or call my dad, and hopefully he'll pick up. But if not, you know, then I'll leave a voicemail saying, hey, I just wanted to thank you for investing and making me the person that I am, that you know, you have made my life a better thing that I have. You know right. What I mean? Like
there are a lot. Look, we know there are a lot of damaged families out there,
yeah. You
know, a lot of damaged kids, a lot of broken relationships and things like that. And it's tragic. But sometimes I think there's more damage from people quitting.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
throwing hands in the air
and just saying, well, I just can't do it. And just doing whatever, or either giving them the money or buying the kid the place, whatever that thing is.
Yeah.
It is the, you know, I quit here.
Yeah. And good luck. You show me how good you know everything. Right. I can imagine.
And
yeah.
That's the beginning of some bad things.
Yeah.
You know, rather than. In my, you know, junior psychologist opinion, just hanging in there, man. Yeah. And just going, just so you understand, kids, daddy has a strong force of will.
Yeah.
You know, he's if you want to stare down with dad, you will lose.
Let's dance.
Yeah.
Do you have, what do you think are the differences between raising boys and girls?
I had three girls in a row and mm-hmm. then a boy, but I am raising him as a girl because I'm not, buying all new stuff. It's just, put on the pink jumper, you'll like it. Put on the, yeah, pink's a macho color.
He doesn't know right now.
It's
right?
not a skirt. It's a kilt. Keep the kilt on. Shut up. Maxi pads, those are knee pads. Stick them back on. Get back on the soccer field with the other kids. It's good sports equipment. I don't know how people with a lot of boys do it.
Really?
Honestly. Because
really?
I'll say on stage, I have three girls and a boy, and people come up, well, we have three boys and a girl.
Yeah.
I say, oh, my God. God help you. How do
really?
You survive? Because boys are so, they're just, you know, Tasmanian devils. They're just dynamos. I must break something. I must make a weapon. And if you give a boy a slice of cheese and a popsicle stick, I'm making a catapult to kill animals. What?
It's true.
You know, and yeah, the girl makes a doll out of it or something. Look, I made a flower out of my cheese.
I realized that it was a male thing because for a while, and I think I've mentioned this on the show, is that right after I became a parent, I was really concerned about my own self-esteem kind of thing. And I wanted to make sure I found a way to correct that. So before I could try to, I accidentally placed it on my kid where he was having the same kind of issue. I was talking to a therapist, and as we kind of figured out where it was all coming from, one of the last things we talked about is I said that, you know, I know it's a stupid concern, and I said, and I don't want to sound insensitive. I said, but I kiss my son an awful lot. I love to hug him and kiss him to the point where I'm afraid of making him effeminate. Not that I really have an issue with him being gay, but that I don't want it to be my fault, really. You know?
Can I say something?
Yeah.
I think that's the smartest thing you can do.
Yeah, that's
and
what
I
he
think
said.
That I think. Really?
Yeah, he said. He goes.
I've been kissing my son. My son is 14. Okay, he wears a size 13 shoe.
Uh-huh.
He's almost 6 feet tall in the ninth grade. Yeah. All right, and I've been kissing him and hugging him his whole life.
Yeah,
and I tell him now. I say, buddy, when you're 25 years old, I'm gonna be kissing you and hugging you. And if all of your friends are making fun of you, guess what? I'm bigger than all your friends. I can kick your friends' butts. So if they make fun of you, just say, why don't you bring it up with my dad?
Yeah.
And he'll pound your head in, and then he'll come over and kiss me again.
Yeah. You know?
So, yeah, hug and kiss my son, and I hug him at night, and I kiss him to, you know, going to bed and everything. And I think it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
I think everyone's just totally nervous, crazy about all that stuff. Just get over
That's
it.
That's what
man.
He said. He said, he goes, first of all, he goes, just to quickly put that to bed, there is no research that says that that's a correlation.
Of course.
He said, second of all, that's what you're supposed to do.
Of course.
That's what
How
you're supposed
this,
to do.
How about this, my son? Your dad loves you.
Yeah.
You know? Dad loves you like crazy, buddy.
Well, and it's funny because I've gotten, people have kind of tried to poke fun at me, but I don't really care. Is that, and I that's what I thought was interesting about it, is that it didn't bother me with my relationship with my dad. I don't know why it snuck in with him and my, with me and my son, but
I've given my dad a kiss goodnight and been 20 to almost 30 years old, you know, and that's just the relationship I have with my dad. I give him a hug, I give him a kiss, and I love the guy, and he loves me, and it's never been an issue, you know, never had a moment of like, yeah, maybe. I mean, there was a time when I got older that maybe I thought maybe it was bugging him, but he never said anything, so I just didn't care. It wasn't bugging him. Yeah, exactly.
I don't think it was bugging him. It's your dad.
Yeah, exactly.
You're kissing your dad, man. Yeah. That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
I think we've so... kind of, you know, the media, the culture has just sort of over weirdly sexualized everything. Yeah. We're going, are you kidding me? Dads can't just kiss their son. We've gone a little crazy now. Yeah. So I hug my son, I kiss him. He's a big side of beef.
Yeah.
And I just, tough, man. I'll put you in a headlock. I'll still kiss you. You can't even get out of it. You can get out maybe when you're 23. Maybe when you get bigger than me, you can wrestle me out of it. Yeah. But then you sleep sometimes.
You're still going to wrestle.
Yeah. You're going to sleep. I'll be kissing your head. You'll be sleeping. Whatever.
Well, and I thought that, you know, even as affectionate as I am towards him, but he's still, like, if you play cars with him and he's 2.5, he can't drive a car next to you. It has to crash violently and throw yours off the footstool.
It's no fun not to have human, you know.
Carnage
and injuries. Come on. If you're not sending somebody to the hospital, there's no fun involved.
Why are we playing? Exactly. Why are we doing this? Yeah, that's great. Well, let's wrap up with that. I'll go first. If you feel comfortable, do you mind sharing like a little? Not it doesn't have to be within the last week, but a moment that you've had with each of your kids recently, or
You do it, and I don't know what I don't really understand it entirely. So you do it, and I'll make something up, or I'll improvise a song.
We'll see. Or you'll just get up and leave. We've made it way past 2 minutes, just so you know. I think we did a good job then.
Really?
Yeah.
That stupid vibrating timer.
Mine was with, it's kind of a bittersweet thing. I'm gone. I'm on the road. And so I do the Skype thing with my son. And he was wanting everyone's attention, you know, so that my mom is visiting and my wife's there. My wife's trying to talk to me on the computer. And he was just, you know, he's yelling, mom, mom. Mom, 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 mom. And she's trying to ignore him because we're trying to teach him to say, excuse me. You know what I mean? And then she goes, and I just, it's cute to me when my wife has these moments where she snaps. She goes, I am talking. Like she puts her hand in and he goes, and then he immediately switches to, excuse me, excuse me. And then she's like still talking to me and he's going, mom, excuse me, mom, excuse me. Like, he's like, now I'm saying the magic word.
Right.
And then she finishes her sentence. She goes, okay, listen to me. I understand that you were saying excuse me, but you also have to wait until I'm done talking. Then you say excuse me. And then before she could finish that sentence, he goes, oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Like, I got it. Yeah, whatever. Mom. Uh-huh. Anyway, the Spider-Man thing I mean to tell you about. And it was just cute and fun, and it was nice to see it on the computer because it was like I was home still, you know, took away a little bit of the homesickness. So that's kind of the idea. You tell a little story about something that was cool as a dad or parent or whatever.
Well, I don't have anything.
Oh, okay. Oh, thank you, Mr. Wilson. he's leaving. Oh, he's gone. He's literally you can find Tom Wilson at TomWilsonUSA.com. You can see YouTube videos. He has the Twitter, all of that stuff. What I would like to... Oh, yeah.
Did you leave a bottle of water in here?
Yes, you did. It's right here on the desk. Do you want anything that you want? No, that's okay. Thank you. Do you want to plug it? No, you're good. Just you just want to go, or do you want to plug anything? Or
no
you're okay. Thank you again. I highly recommend going to the iTunes. Just search for Tom Wilson. You could get Tom Wilson. Tom is Funny, I believe, is the name of one of his albums, and the other one is Bigger Than You. Definitely check those out, especially for our trucker fans out there. It's definitely a good way to kill an hour or so while you're out on the road. So thank you again to Tom Wilson. And please, for anybody who doesn't understand the bits that he just did, I don't want you to think, man, he was really nice, and then he just became a jerk in the last 30 seconds. So check him out. He's also an artist, great art. All of that is available at TomWilsonUSA.com. And on behalf of my good friend Tom Wilson, and I cannot explain enough how incredible this week has been for me comedically and just an all-around good time. So on behalf of Tom Wilson, this is Justin Worsham saying, stay frosty.